Welcome to the Hackberry House of Chosun. My name is Bob, reading today from Free Grace Broadcaster of Fall 2021. The subject is temptation during this entire quarterly. Some of the men of God we've heard from so far, John Newton and Thomas Mantone and J.C. Ryle, they've all talked about temptation. And so Jonathan Edwards is going to talk about temptation this time around. Jonathan Edwards lived from 1703 to 1758. He was that American congregational preacher and theologian who gave us Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. You may have recalled that one. Born in the colony called Connecticut a couple hundred years back. All right, 300, 400. Anyway, let's just move on. Determining what leads to sin. Jonathan Edwards, how shall we know what things do lead and expose to sin? Let a man do what he will, he cannot avoid sinning if he has such a corrupt heart within him. And there is nothing a man can do, but he may find some temptation in it. Though it be true that a man ought to avoid those things that lead and expose to sin, and that the things that have a special tendency to expose men to sin are what we ought to shun as much as in us lies, yet how shall we judge and determine what things have a natural tendency to sin or do especially lead to it? I would answer in some particulars that are plain and easy. They cannot be denied without the greatest absurdity. Number one, that which borders on those sins to which the lusts of men's hearts strongly incline them is of this sort. Men come into the world with many strong and violent lusts in their hearts, and are exceeding prone of themselves to transgress, even in the safest circumstances in which they can be placed. Surely, so much the nearer they are to that sin to which they are naturally strongly inclined, so much the more are they exposed. If any of us who are parents should see our children near the brink of some deep pit or close by the edge of the precipice of a high mountain, and not only so, but the ground upon which the child stood was slippery and steeply descending directly toward the precipice, should we not reckon a child exposed in such a case? Should we not be in haste to remove the child from its very dangerous situation? It was the manner among the Israelites to build their houses with flat roofs, so that persons might walk on the tops of their houses. Therefore God took care to make it a law among them that every man should have battlements upon the edges of their roofs, that's low walls or barriers, lest any person should fall off and be killed. Deuteronomy 22:8, when thou buildest a new house, then thou shalt make a battlement for thy roof, that thou bring not blood upon thine house, if any man fall from thence. Well, certainly we ought to take the like care that we do not fall into sin, which carries in it eternal death. We should, as it were, fix a battlement, a guard, to keep us from the edge of the precipice. Much more ought we to take care that we do not go upon a roof that is not only without battlements, but also when it is steep, and we shall naturally incline to fall. Men's lusts are like strong enemies, endeavoring to draw them into sin. If a man stood upon a dangerous precipice and had enemies about him, pulling, drawing, and endeavoring to throw him down, would he in such a case choose or dare to stand near the edge? Would he not endeavor for his own safety to keep at a distance? Number two, those things that tend to feed lusts in the imagination are of this kind. They lead and expose men to sin. Those things that have a natural tendency to excite in the mind the imagination of that which is the object of the lust certainly tend to feed and promote that lust. What can be more evident than that a presenting of the object tends to stir up the appetite? reason and experience teach this. Therefore, all things, whether words or actions, which have a tendency to and expose to sin, tend also to raise in the mind imaginations of what the lust tends to. It is certainly wrong to feed a lust, even in the imagination. It is quite contrary to the holy rules of God's words. It says, "The thought of foolishness is sin," Proverbs 24:9. "Whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery," Matthew 5:28. A man, by gratifying his lusts in his imagination and thoughts, may make his soul in the sight of God to be a hold of foul spirits and like a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. And sinful imaginations tend to sinful actions and outward behavior in the end. Lust is always first conceived in the imagination and then brought forth in the outward practice. You may see the progress of it in James 1:15. "Then when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin." Such things are abominable in the sight of a pure and holy God. We are commanded to keep at a great distance from spiritual pollution and to hate even the very garment spotted by the flesh. Number three, those things that the experience and observation of mankind show to be ordinarily attended or followed with sin are of this sort. Experience is a good rule by which to determine things of this nature. How do we know the natural tendency of anything but by observation and experience? Men observe and find that some things are commonly attended and followed with other things. Hence, mankind pronounce that they have a natural tendency to them. We have no other way to know the tendency of anything. Thus, men by observation and experience know that the warmth of the sun and showers of rain are attended with the growth of plants. Hence, they learn that they have a tendency to it. So they find by experience that the bite of some kinds of serpents is commonly followed with illness and often with death. Hence, they learn that the bite of such serpents has a natural tendency to bring disorder upon the body and exposes to death. So, if experience and common observation show that any particular practice or custom is commonly attended with that which is very sinful, we may safely conclude that such a practice tends to sin, that it leads and exposes to it. Thus, we may determine that tavern haunting and gaming are things that tend to sin because common experience and observation show that those practices are attended with a great deal of sin and wickedness. The observation of all ages and all nations with one voice declares it. It shows that where taverns are much frequented for drinking and the like, they are especially places of sin, profaneness, and other wickedness. And it shows that those towns where there is much of this are places where no good generally prevails. It also shows that those persons that are given much to frequenting taverns are most commonly vicious persons. Vicious meaning addicted to immorality or vice. Wicked, not vicious as we understand it, but still bad. And so with gaming and playing at cards, experience shows that those persons that practice this do generally fall into much sin. Hence, these practices are become infamous among all sober, virtuous persons. Number four, another way by which persons may determine that some things lead and expose to sin is by their own experience or what they have found in themselves. Well, this surely is enough to convince them that such things actually lead and expose to sin. For what will convince men if their own experience will not? Thus, if men have found by undeniable experience that any practice or custom stirs up lust in them and has betrayed them into foolish and sinful behavior or sinful thoughts, they may determine that they lead to sin. If they, upon examining themselves, must own that a custom or practice has disposed them to the omission of known duty, such as secret or family prayer, and has indisposed them to reading and religious meditation, or if they find, since they have complied with such a custom, they are less watchful of their hearts, less disposed to anything that is serious, that the frame of their mind is more light and their hearts less disposed on the things of another world and more after vanity. These are sinful effects. Therefore, if experience shows a custom or practice to be attended with these things, then experience shows that they lead and expose to sin. Number 5, we may determine whether a thing be of an evil tendency or not by the effect that an outpouring of the Spirit of God and a general flourishing of religion has with respect to it. If this puts a stop to any practice or custom and roots it out, surely it argues that that practice or custom is of no good tendency. For if there be no hurt in it, and it tends to no hurt, why should the Spirit of God destroy it? The Spirit of God has no tendency to destroy anything that is neither sinful nor has any tendency to sin. Why should it? Why should we suppose that he is an enemy to that which has no hurt in it, nor has any tendency to that which is hurtful? The flourishing of religion has no tendency to abolish or expel anything that is no way against religion. That which is not against religion, religion will not appear against. It is a rule that holds in all contraries and opposites. The opposition is equal on both sides. So contrary as light is to darkness, so contrary is darkness to light. So contrary as the flourishing of religion is to any custom, just so contrary is that custom to the flourishing of religion. That custom that religion tends to destroy, that custom, if it prevails, tends also to destroy religion. Therefore, if the flourishing of religion and the outpouring of the Spirit of God tends to overthrow any custom that takes place or prevails, we may surely determine that that custom is either in itself sinful or tends and exposes to evil. Number 6, we may determine by the effect that a general decay of religion has with respect to them, whether they be things of a sinful tendency or not. If they be things that come with a decay of religion, that creep in as that decays, we may determine they are things of no good tendency. The withdrawing of good does not let in good, but evil. Evil, not good, comes in as good gradually ceases. What is it but darkness that comes in as light withdraws? And number 7, we may in many things determine whether any custom be of a good tendency by considering what the effect would be if it was openly and universally owned and practiced. There are many things that persons practice somewhat secretly, which they plead to be not hurtful, but which, if they had suitable consideration to discern the consequence of everybody openly practicing the same, would soon show a most woeful state of things. If therefore there be any custom that will not bear universal open practice and profession, we may determine that that custom is of an ill tendency. For if it is neither sinful nor tends to anything sinful, then it is no matter how open it is, for we need not be afraid of that custom being too prevalent and universal that has no ill tendency in it. Amen. That's from Temptation and Deliverance, or Joseph's Great Temptation and Gracious Deliverance, and the works of Jonathan Edwards in the public domain. Thank you so much for being here today, as always. We have one more look. There are several men in here that we're going to pass over. You don't know them too well. I don't know them too well. They're good men. They are speaking good things. But I want to go with the men who are most familiar to you. And the one, I guess, that is the most familiar to all of us is a fellow named Spurgeon, Charles H. Next time around, we'll close out this Free Grace broadcaster with Mr. Spurgeon's piece entitled, Christ is Able to Help, as we keep looking at temptation this week. Thank you so much again. Come back and do look around the website while I'm gone. Lots of things to see there, really. I won't go through it all like I do often, but do look for yourself. You'll find some other blessings, I do believe. Well, this is the Hackberry House of Chosun, and Lord willing, we'll talk again real soon. Bye-bye.